Chapter 10. The Grand Martian Hotel now had no less than 2 residents, a state of affairs which imposed a severe strain on its temporary staff. The rest of his shipmates had made private arrangements for their accommodation in Port Lowell, but as he knew no one in the city, Jimmy had decided to accept official hospitality. Gibson wondered if this was going to be a success. He did not wish to throw too great a strain on their still somewhat provisional friendship, and if Jimmy saw too much of him, the results might be disastrous. He remembered an epigram which his best enemy had once concocted. "Martin's one of the nicest fellows you could meet, as long as you don't do it too often." There was enough truth in this to make it sting, and he had no wish to put it to the test again. His life in the port had now settled down to a fairly steady routine. In the morning he would work, putting on paper his impressions of Mars, rather a presumptuous thing to do when he considered just how much of the planet he had so far seen. The afternoon was reserved for tours of inspection and interviews with the city's inhabitants. Sometimes Jimmy went with him on these trips, and once the whole of the Ares crew came along to the hospital to see how Dr. Scott and his colleagues were progressing with their battle against Martian fever. It was still too early to draw any conclusions, but Scott seemed fairly optimistic. "What we'd like to have," he said, rubbing his hands ghoulishly, "is a really good epidemic so that we could test the stuff properly. We haven't enough cases at the moment." Jimmy had 2 reasons for accompanying Gibson on his tours of the city. In the first place, the older man could go almost anywhere he pleased, and so could get into all the interesting places which might otherwise be out of bounds. The second reason was a purely personal one, his increasing interest in the curious character of Martin Gibson. Though they had now been thrown so closely together, they had never reopened their earlier conversation. Jimmy knew that Gibson was anxious to be friends and to make some recompense for whatever had happened in the past. He was quite capable of accepting this offer on a purely impersonal basis, for he realized well enough that Gibson could be extremely useful to him in his career. Like most ambitious young men, Jimmy had a streak of coldly calculating self-interest in his makeup, and Gibson would have been slightly dismayed at some of the appraisals which Jimmy had made of the advantages to be obtained from his patronage. It would, however, be quite unfair to Jimmy to suggest that these material considerations were uppermost in his mind. There were times when he sensed Gibson's inner loneliness, the loneliness of the bachelor facing the approach of middle age. Perhaps Jimmy also realized, though not consciously as yet, that to Gibson he was beginning to represent the son he had never had. It was not a role that Jimmy was by any means sure he wanted, yet there were often times when he felt sorry for Gibson and would have been glad to please him. It is, after all, very difficult not to feel a certain affection towards someone who likes you. The accident that introduced a new and quite unexpected element into Jimmy's life was really very trivial. He had been out alone one afternoon and, feeling thirsty, had dropped into the small cafe opposite the administration building. Unfortunately, he had not chosen his time well, for while he was quietly sipping a cup of tea, which had never been within millions of kilometers of Ceylon, the place was suddenly invaded. It was the 20-minute afternoon break when all work stopped on Mars, a rule which the chief executive had enforced in the interest of efficiency, though everyone would have much preferred to do without it and leave work 20 minutes earlier instead. Jimmy was rapidly surrounded by an army of young women who eyed him with alarming candor and a complete lack of diffidence. Although 6 men had been swept in on the flood, they crowded round one table for mutual protection, and judging by their intense expressions, continued to battle mentally with the files they had left on their desks. Jimmy decided to finish his drink as quickly as he could and get out. A rather tough-looking woman in her late 30s, probably a senior secretary, was sitting opposite him, talking to a much younger girl in his side of the table. It was quite a squeeze to get past, and as Jimmy pushed into the crowd swirling through the narrow gangway, he tripped over an outstretched foot. He grabbed the table as he fell and managed to avoid complete disaster, but only at the cost of catching his elbow a sickening crack on the glass top. Forgetting in his agony that he was no longer back in the Ares, he relieved his feelings with a few well-chosen words. Then, blushing furiously, he recovered and bolted to freedom. He caught a glimpse of the elder woman trying hard not to laugh, and the younger one not even attempting such self-control. And then, though it seemed inconceivable in retrospect, he forgot all about them both. It was Gibson who quite accidentally provided the second stimulus. They were talking about the swift growth of the city during the last few years and wondering if it would continue in the future. Gibson had remarked on the abnormal age distribution caused by the fact that no one under 21 had been allowed to emigrate to Mars, so that there was a complete gap between the ages of 10 and 21, a gap which, of course, the high birth rate of the colony would soon fill. Jimmy had been listening half-heartedly when one of Gibson's remarks made him suddenly look up. "That's funny," he said. "Yesterday I saw a girl who couldn't have been more than 18." And then he stopped. For, like a delayed-action bomb, the memory of that girl's laughing face as he had stumbled from the café suddenly exploded in his mind. He never heard Gibson tell him that he must have been mistaken. He only knew that, whoever she was and wherever she had come from, he had to see her again. In a place the size of Port Lowell, it was only a matter of time before one met everybody. The laws of chance would see to that. Jimmy, however, had no intention of waiting until these doubtful allies arranged a second encounter. The following day, just before the afternoon break, he was drinking tea at the same table in the little café. This not very subtle move had caused him some mental anguish. In the first case, it might seem altogether too obvious. Yet, why shouldn't he have tea here when most of admin did the same? A second and weightier objection was the memory of the previous day's debacle. But Jimmy remembered an apt quotation about faint hearts and fair ladies. His qualms were unnecessary. Though he waited until the café had emptied again, there was no sign of the girl or her companion. They must have gone somewhere else. It was an annoying but only temporary setback to so resourceful a young man as Jimmy. Almost certainly she worked in the admin building, and there were innumerable excuses for visiting that. He could think of inquiries about his pay, though these would hardly get him into the depths of the filing system or the stenographer's office, where she probably worked. It would be best simply to keep an eye on the building when the staff arrived and left, though how this could be done unobtrusively was a considerable problem. Before he had made any attempt to solve it, fate stepped in again, heavily disguised as Martin Gibson, slightly short of breath. "I've been looking everywhere for you, Jimmy. Better hurry up and get dressed. You know there's a show tonight. Well, we've all been invited to have dinner with the chief before going. That's in 2 hours." "What does one wear for formal dinners on Mars?" asked Jimmy. "Black shorts and white tie, I think," said Gibson, a little doubtfully. "Or is it the other way round? Anyway, they'll tell us at the hotel. I hope they can find something that fits me." They did, but only just. Evening dress on Mars, where in the heat and air-conditioned cities all clothes were kept to a minimum, consisted simply of a white silk shirt with 2 rows of pearl buttons, a black bow tie, and black satin shorts with a belt of wide aluminum links on an elastic backing. It was smarter than might have been expected, but when fitted out, Gibson felt something midway between a Boy Scout and little Lord Fauntleroy. Norden and Hilton, on the other hand, carried it off quite well. Mackay and Scott were less successful, and Bradley obviously didn't give a damn. The chief's residence was the largest private house on Mars, though on Earth it would have been a very modest affair. They assembled in the lounge for a chat and sherry, real sherry, before the meal. Mayor Whittaker, being Hadfield's second-in-command, had also been invited, and as he listened to them talking to Norden, Gibson understood for the first time with what respect and admiration the colonists regarded the men who provided their sole link with Earth. Hadfield was holding forth at some length about the Ares, waxing quite lyrical over her speed and payload, and the effects these would have on the economy of Mars. "Before we go in," said the chief when they had finished the sherry, "I'd like you to meet my daughter. She's just seen to the arrangements. Excuse me a moment while I fetch her." He was gone only a few seconds. "This is Irene," he said, in a voice that tried not to be proud but failed completely. One by one he introduced her to his guests, coming to Jimmy last. Irene looked at him and smiled sweetly. "I think we've met before," she said. Jimmy's color heightened, but he held his ground and smiled back. "So we have," he replied. It was really very foolish of him not to have guessed. If he had even started to think properly, he would have known who she must have been. On Mars, the only man who could break the rules was the one who enforced them. Jimmy remembered hearing that the chief had a daughter, but he had never connected the facts together. It all fell into place now. When Hadfield and his wife came to Mars, they had brought their only child with them as part of the contract. No one else had ever been allowed to do so. The meal was an excellent one, but it was largely wasted on Jimmy. He had not exactly lost his appetite. That would have been unthinkable. But he ate with a distracted air. As he was seated near the end of the table, he could see Irene only by dint of craning his neck in a most ungentlemanly fashion. He was very glad when the meal was over and they adjourned for coffee. The other two members of the chief executive's household were waiting for the guests. Already occupying the best seats, a pair of beautiful Siamese cats regarded the visitors with fathomless eyes. They were introduced as Topaz and Turquoise, and Gibson, who loved cats, immediately started to try and make friends with them. "Are you fond of cats?" Irene asked Jimmy. "Rather," said Jimmy, who loathed them. "How long have they been here?" "Oh, about a year. Just fancy, they're the only animals on Mars. I wonder if they appreciate it." "I'm sure Mars does. Don't they get spoiled?" "They're too independent. I don't think they really care for anyone, not even Daddy, though he likes to pretend they do." With great subtlety, though to any spectator it would have been fairly obvious that Irene was always one jump ahead of him, Jimmy brought the conversation round to more personal matters. He discovered that she worked in the accounting section, but knew a good deal of everything that went on in administration, where she one day hoped to hold a responsible executive post. Jimmy guessed that her father's position had been, if anything, a slight handicap to her. Though it must have made life easier in some ways, in others it would be a definite disadvantage, as Port Lowell was fiercely democratic. It was very hard to keep Irene on the subject of Mars. She was much more anxious to hear about Earth, the planet which she had left when a child, and so must have, in her mind, a dreamlike unreality. Jimmy did his best to answer her questions, quite content to talk about anything which held her interest. He spoke of Earth's great cities, its mountains and seas, its blue skies and scudding clouds, its rivers and rainbows, all the things which Mars had lost. And as he talked, he fell deeper and deeper beneath the spell of Irene's laughing eyes. That was the only word to describe them. She always seemed to be on the point of sharing some secret joke. Was she still laughing at him? Jimmy wasn't sure, and he didn't mind. What rubbish it was, he thought, to imagine that one became tongue-tied on these occasions. He had never been more fluent in his life. He was suddenly aware that a great silence had fallen. Everyone was looking at him and Irene. "Huh," said the chief executive. "If you two have quite finished, we'd better get a move on. The show starts in 10 minutes. Most of Port Lowell seemed to have squeezed into the little theater by the time they arrived. Mayor Whittaker, who had hurried ahead to check the arrangements, met them at the door and shepherded them into their seats, a reserved block occupying most of the front row. Gibson, Hadfield, and Irene were in the center, flanked by Norden and Hilton, much to Jimmy's chagrin. He had no alternative but to look at the show. Like all such amateur performances, it was good in parts. The musical items were excellent, and there was one mezzo-soprano who was up to the best professional standards of Earth. Gibson was not surprised when he saw against her name on the program, "Late of the Royal Covent Garden Opera." A dramatic interlude then followed, the distressed heroine and old-time villain hamming it for all they were worth. The audience loved it, cheering and booing the appropriate characters and shouting gratuitous advice. Next came one of the most astonishing ventriloquist acts that Gibson had ever seen. It was nearly over before he realized, only a minute before the performer revealed it deliberately, that there was a radio receiver inside the doll and an accomplice offstage. The next item appeared to be a skit on life in the city, and was so full of local allusions that Gibson understood only part of it. However, the antics of the main character, a harassed official obviously modeled on Mayor Whittaker, drew roars of laughter. These increased still further when he began to be pestered by a fantastic person who was continually asking ridiculous questions, noting the answers in a little book, which he was always losing, and photographing everything in sight. It was several minutes before Gibson realized just what was going on. For a moment, he turned a deep red. Then he realized that there was only one thing he could do. He would have to laugh louder than anyone else. The proceedings ended with community singing, a form of entertainment which Gibson did not normally go out of his way to seek, rather the reverse, in fact. But he found it more enjoyable than he had expected, and as he joined in the last choruses, a sudden wave of emotion swept over him, causing his voice to peter out into nothingness. For a moment he sat, the only silent man in all that crowd, wondering what had happened to him. The faces around provided the answer. Here were men and women, united in a single task, driving towards a common goal, each knowing that their work was vital to the community. They had a sense of fulfillment which very few could know on Earth, where all the frontiers had long ago been reached. It was a sense heightened and made more personal by the fact that Port Lowell was still so small that everyone knew everybody else. Of course, it was too good to last. As the colony grew, the spirit of these pioneering days would fade. Everything would become too big and too well organized. The development of the planet would be just another job of work. But for the present, it was a wonderful sensation, which a man would be lucky indeed to experience even once in his lifetime. Gibson knew it was felt by all those around him, yet he could not share it. He was an outsider. That was the role he had always preferred to play, and now he had played it long enough. If it was not too late, he wanted to join in the game. That was the moment, if indeed there was such a single point in time, when Martin Gibson changed his allegiance from Earth to Mars. No one ever knew. Even those beside him, if they noticed anything at all, were aware only that for a few seconds he had stopped singing, but had now joined in the chorus again with redoubled vigor. In twos and threes, laughing, talking, and singing, the audience slowly dissolved into the night. Gibson and his friends started back towards the hotel, having said goodbye to the chief and Mayor Whittaker. The two men who virtually ran Mars watched them disappear down the narrow streets. Then Hadfield turned to his daughter and remarked quietly, "Run along home now, dear. Mr. Whittaker and I are going for a little walk. I'll be back in half an hour." They waited, answering good nights from time to time, until the tiny square was deserted. Mayor Whittaker, who guessed what was coming, fidgeted slightly.
"Remind me to congratulate George on tonight's show," said Hadfield.
"Yes," Whittaker replied. "I love the skit on our mutual headache, Gibson. I suppose you want to conduct a post-mortem on his latest exploit?"
The chief was slightly taken aback by this direct approach.
"It's rather too late now, and there's no real evidence that any real harm was done. I'm just wondering how to prevent future accidents."
"It was hardly the driver's fault. He didn't know about the project, and it was pure bad luck that he stumbled on it."
"Do you think Gibson suspects anything?"
"Frankly, I don't know. He's pretty shrewd.
Of all the times to send a reporter here, I did everything I could to keep him away, heaven knows.
He's bound to find out that something's happening before he's here much longer. I think there's only one solution."
"What's that?"
"We'll just have to tell him. Perhaps not everything, but enough."
They walked in silence for a few yards. Then Hadfield remarked,
"That's pretty drastic. You're assuming he can be trusted completely."
"I've seen a good deal of him these last weeks. Fundamentally, he's on our side. You see, we're doing the sort of things he's been writing about all his life, though he can't quite believe it yet. What would be fatal would be to let him go back to Earth suspecting something but not knowing what."
There was another long silence. They reached the limit of the dome and stared across the glimmering Martian landscape, dimly lit by the radiance spilling out from the city.
"I'll have to think it over," said Hadfield, turning to retrace his footsteps. "Of course, a lot depends on how quickly things move."
"Any hints yet?"
"No, confound them. You never can pin scientists down to a date."
A young couple, arms twined together, strolled past them obliviously. Whittaker chuckled.
"That reminds me. Irene seems to have taken quite a fancy to that youngster. What's his name? Spencer."
"No, I don't know. It's a change to see a fresh face around, and space travel is so much more romantic than the work we do here."
"All the nice girls love a sailor, eh? Well, don't say I didn't warn you."
That something had happened to Jimmy was soon perfectly obvious to Gibson, and it took him no more than two guesses to arrive at the correct answer. He quite approved of the lad's choice. Irene seemed a very nice child, from what little he had seen of her. She was rather unsophisticated, but this was not necessarily a handicap. Much more important was the fact that she had a gay and cheerful disposition, though once or twice Gibson had caught her in a mood of wistfulness that was very attractive. She was also extremely pretty. Gibson was now old enough to realize that this was not all important, though Jimmy might have different views on the subject. At first, he decided to say nothing about the matter until Jimmy raised it himself. In all probability, the boy was still under the impression that no one had noticed anything in the least unusual. Gibson's self-control gave way, however, when Jimmy announced his intention of taking a temporary job in Port Lowell. There was nothing odd about this. Indeed, it was a common practice among visiting space crews, who soon got bored if they had nothing to do between trips. The work they chose was invariably technical and related in some way to their professional activities. Mackay, for example, was running evening classes in mathematics, while poor Dr. Scott had had no holiday at all, but had gone straight to the hospital immediately on reaching Port Lowell. But Jimmy, it seemed, wanted a change. They were short of staff in the accounting section, and he thought his knowledge of mathematics might help. He put up an astonishingly convincing argument, to which Gibson listened with genuine pleasure. "My dear Jimmy," he said when it was finished, "why tell me all this? There's nothing to stop your going right ahead if you want to."
"I know," said Jimmy, "but you see a lot of Mayor Whittaker, and it might save trouble if you had a word with him."
"I'll speak to the chief, if you like."
"Oh, no, I shouldn't," Jimmy began. Then he tried to retrieve his blunder. "It isn't worth bothering him about such details."
"Look here, Jimmy," said Gibson with great firmness. "Why not come clean? Is this your idea? Or did Irene put you up to it?"
It was worth traveling all the way to Mars to see Jimmy's expression. He looked rather like a fish that had been breathing air for some time, and had only just realized it.
"Oh," he said at last, "I didn't know you knew. You won't tell anyone, will you?"
Gibson was just about to remark that this would be quite unnecessary, but there was something in Jimmy's eyes that made him abandon all attempts at humor. The wheel had come full circle. He was back again in that 20-year-old buried spring. He knew exactly what Jimmy was feeling now, and knew also that nothing which the future could bring to him would ever match the emotions he was discovering, still as new and fresh as on the first morning of the world. He might fall in love again in later days, but the memory of Irene would shape and color all his life, just as Irene herself must be the memory of some ideal he had brought with him into this universe. "I'll do what I can," said Gibson gently, and meant it with all his heart. Though history might repeat itself, it never did so exactly, and one generation could learn from the errors of the last. Some things were beyond planning or foresight, but he would do all he could to help, and this time, perhaps, the outcome might be different.